9 o'clock docket. Maddox versus Vantage Energy LLC. If the clerk will please announce counsel for the parties who are arguing. Mr. Donheiser.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, my name is Mark Donheiser and I represent Joseph and Patty Maddox and Linda Weber, the appellants in this matter. This is the second of three similar cases that are going to be before this court. The first was argued, Justice McCoy was on the panel in October. Third will be argued probably somewhere in March or April. They're similar cases. Each involves a different neighborhood association and a different gas company. But the similarities are that each of these pairs of gas companies and neighborhood associations entered into a similar deal. They're not the negotiations aren't the same, the deals aren't the same, but they're similar. A deal where the neighborhood association would endorse a gas company and help it organize the neighborhood in exchange for the gas company agreeing to offer a lease under certain terms, under the agreed terms on an agreed lease form to unleased mineral estate owners within the geographical boundaries. And that's what happened here. The Southwest Fort Worth Alliance is an unincorporated association which was formed for this purpose, to negotiate in its neighborhood. Before these entities arose, the gas companies were simply sending landmen out into the neighborhoods, knocking on doors, leaving flyers in mailboxes. It was chaos. Entities like CIFWA were a godsend to the gas companies. It allowed them to lock up a neighborhood, an area, without having to go door to door, and the endorsement gave them a competitive advantage over everyone else who was sending their landmen in knocking on doors. And so that is the deal we're talking about here, the contract. We're not talking about a contract between Joseph Maddox and Vantage. We're suing as third-party beneficiaries of a contract between CIFWA, unincorporated associations are allowed to contract in Texas, and Vantage. And there really is no dispute here that a deal was reached between those two. Vantage refers to it as a deal. We have an agreement. When CIFWA made its endorsement, it sent it in advance to Vantage. Is it okay if we say we have a deal and that you are the endorsed gas company? And Vantage said yes. They repeatedly refer to it as a deal. The parties, CIFWA, to this contract, CIFWA and Vantage, then performed for weeks. CIFWA publicly endorsed Vantage as the gas company of choice for this area and proceeded to help Vantage set up what were called signing events to go through the area one at a time, setting these up. And CIFWA played an important part in that through its website, through its email blasts, and through a phone voicemail system that it had set up to alert people as to where you are supposed to go at what time for your signing event. Somewhere between 4,000 and 7,500 leases were obtained by Vantage based on CIFWA's performance until it decided it didn't want to do this anymore and breached. My clients never got a signing event in their particular area and are suing as third-party beneficiaries of that agreement. And there can be no doubt that they're third-party beneficiaries. Vantage and CIFWA agreed to a lease form. This is the lease form we're going to do. That lease form itself discusses CIFWA's role in negotiating this for the benefit of the neighborhoods which make up the geographic boundaries of CIFWA.
Doesn't your client's admission that each person in these respective neighborhoods had the right to renegotiate the lease or accept or reject the contract, doesn't that shoot a hole in your theory?
Or to sign with somebody else, Your Honor. They didn't have to sign with Vantage. They could negotiate a better deal if they could find it with XTO or Chesapeake or anybody else out there. No, it doesn't, Your Honor. Third-party beneficiaries, the contract was to make the offer to these people. I'm assuming that through the state, the honorable members of the panel are given health insurance. One of the options, and that's a classic third-party beneficiary contract, insurance. One of the options is you may sign up your spouse and children if you want to. You don't have to. You may not have spouses or children, or they may have better insurance through another employer. It's your option. Doesn't mean it's not a contract by a contract between the state and Blue Cross or whoever it is that is binding, and that they have to do it if you meet the requirements and so choose. So the fact that it's optional is not. That's very common in third-party beneficiary contracts. What Vantage argues, its main argument, is that the statute of frauds bars all of this. It doesn't, there is no agreement between Mr. Maddox and Vantage signed. In fact, they argue there's no, the contract between CIFWA and Vantage, which they agree happened. I mean, the Vantage witnesses say there was a deal for the endorsement, but it's not in writing and it involves real estate. And Justice McCoy heard an awful lot of argument about whether the statute of fraud applies to the contract between CIFWA and Vantage, and I'm not going to go over all of that again. It's in our briefs. What I want to talk about today is the performance exception to the statute of frauds, because there's no doubt, evidence is almost undisputed, but certainly a fact issue, that CIFWA performed, fully performed, everything it was required to do. Statute of frauds cannot be relied upon by a party who lets the other side perform and then takes full advantage of that performance. That's black letter law, and that's exactly what happened here. CIFWA did everything it was supposed to do. And Vantage also performed. It went to these signing events that CIFWA helped organize. It offered the lease terms on the lease form to the people that showed up at each of these signing events and signed up somewhere between 4,000 and 7,500 people, 7,500 property owners within this geographical boundary. And Vantage, again, in their brief, they don't seem to seriously argue that CIFWA didn't perform or we didn't perform. They make two legal arguments. First, they say that a third-party beneficiary cannot rely on the performance of the contracting parties to get around the statute of frauds. Only the contracting parties can. Why? That rule of law, they don't really give any explanation why that should be the case. They merely take language out of context from one case that doesn't deal with a third-party beneficiary contract at all and say, well, they're not, they didn't get the benefit. The third-party beneficiaries didn't perform, so they shouldn't get the benefit of the statute of frauds. Why should this be the rule? There are no Texas cases so stating. The classic example of the third-party beneficiary contract is what I've just stated before, insurance. Life insurance is the classic example. Throughout the restatement, as is adopted in Texas, they give examples of the life insurance. Vantage is asking this court to say the insured does everything it's supposed to do under the policy, does all the paperwork, pays premiums for all the years it's supposed to. The beneficiary can't rely on that performance. Only the insured, who, of course, by that time is deceased, by the time you're collecting on the policy. It makes no sense. And what is the purpose behind the promise, performance doctrine? Well, first, the statute of frauds itself, the purpose is to prevent fraud and perjury and to require certain important types of contracts to be in writing to prevent that, to prevent swearing matches as to the existence of the contract. Well, if the parties to the contract have performed, then the existence of the contract, that's compelling, if not conclusive evidence that there is a contract. So the swearing match issue becomes much less important. The second purpose behind the performance doctrine is fundamental fairness. A party who accepts the benefit of the contract, accepts the benefit of whatever the other side is giving them, simply shouldn't be allowed to say, okay, I got this benefit, I like it, thank you very much, there's no signature, I'm walking away. It's a fairness doctrine. If you look at those as the purposes of the performance exception, that it first shows that there is a contract, and so the purpose of the statute of fraud is satisfied, and second, fairness, that applies equally, those purposes apply equally well to the third-party beneficiary. There is no reason for this new rule that Vantage wants you to apply to this case. A third-party beneficiary contract by its nature is for the benefit of someone else. So if you're performing it for them, why shouldn't they get the benefit of your performance? The second legal argument that Vantage makes is that for partial performance, and we say this is a full performance situation, that CIFWA did everything, but for partial performance, they've got cases that say in a transfer of real estate contract, contracts for the conveyance of real property, that for the performance doctrine to apply, the seller must part with possession and the purchaser must rely on that the transfer of possession by making improvements or some other action to show. The very nature of that argument shows why a statute of fraud shouldn't apply in the first place. That is never going to happen in this case. CIFWA and Vantage are the contracting parties. CIFWA has no real property interests. It was not purporting or trying to transfer any real property interests. It couldn't. Vantage wasn't expecting it to. Vantage was purchasing an endorsement. It wasn't purchasing real property interests from CIFWA. That can't apply. In fact, it shows why the statute of frauds doesn't apply at all, because this is not.
That's not what your clients are seeking to enforce, was the endorsement elements. I mean, if they're not purchasing anything but an endorsement, then where's the breach of contract?
The endorsement is CIFWA's promise. CIFWA's in consideration in the contract. Vantage's consideration is We'll agree to lease terms, we'll agree to lease form, and we'll make it available to everyone within this geographical area that wishes to lease their minerals. That is the contract we're suing. We're a third-party beneficiary of that contract. We're not saying we have a contract with Vantage.
But then the terms aren't just for an endorsement. I mean, you're relying on that to get out from under the statute of frauds, but that's not really what you're suing on.
We're suing on that contract. Contract is mutual promises. Vantage made promises to CIFWA. CIFWA made promises to Vantage. CIFWA performed its promises. That makes a contract. This contract was for our benefits. It's like the life insurance policy, or the, I think even better, the health insurance policy, where we're the children. Yes, the agreement is between Blue Cross and the state, but we have the option to join in to be insureds if we want to be. That's a fair way to put it. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Donheiser. Mr. Herman.
May it please the court. I think I want to start by just briefly discussing the Miles versus XTO case and to simply acknowledge that that case, which was argued a couple of months ago, certainly has overlapping issues and theories. And my suspicion is the outcome of that case, whether it is determinative or not of this case, will certainly have a significant influence on the result in this case. I want to start out addressing Mr. Donheiser's opening remark that there is no dispute that a deal was reached. From my perspective, that is not a meaningful question or observation to ask. The question to ask is whether a legally enforceable contract was reached so that, in this instance, the plaintiffs and appellants can accomplish what they seek, which is to have the lower court order my client Vantage to enter into an oil and gas lease with them.
To offer
so that they can accept. I frankly, Justice McCoy, have struggled with how would the court's order ultimately be framed if the appellants were to prevail. Are my clients going to be obliged to basically draft an oil and gas lease that is going to be an open-ended, irrevocable offer? And how is the irrevocability of that going to be addressed in the court order? But obviously, we don't think that it ever gets to that point. And I do think, Justice Walker, you are point on in your question, because what we cannot lose sight of is that CIFWA is not a party to this litigation. And CIFWA is not asking and was not asking the trial court or this court to do anything. It is the individual plaintiffs and the appellants who are the parties who admittedly have no agreement with my clients, Vantage and the Caffey Group. I also want to speak to Mr. Donheiser's comments about fairness and fundamental fairness. The statute of frauds is part of the fabric of the public policy of this state. It is inherently fair. to enforce the public policy of the state. And for someone to come into court and say, it is unfair to me that I am being asked to conduct my business in a manner that is consistent with the state's public policy, seems to me to be asking a lot. Mr. Donheiser touched on the leasing process. The briefs really don't explain that. I want to spend a couple of minutes talking about that. Because if you look at the appellant's case, you would think that the arrival at this skeleton lease form was the be-all, end-all of this deal. And indeed, it was only the very first step of a multi-step process that might eventually lead to the execution of oil and gas leases. What would happen was, after the lease form, the skeleton lease form, was arrived at, there would be meetings in neighborhoods, and people would be invited to attend those meetings. And when they attended, they would receive a lease packet that had been pre-prepared, that had a lease form that was peculiar to them and their property. They could accept that lease, they could reject that lease, they could renegotiate that lease, they could argue for more bonus, they could argue about property descriptions. They were free to do whatever they wanted to do. They were not bound to do anything. And if they eventually did negotiate a lease at that point or thereafter that was acceptable to them and they signed it, there was still the process of title curing, validating ownership, doing everything that was necessary to make sure that the lease would ultimately be a valid lease. Only at that point would the bonus be paid and the lease be executed by the lessee. In this instance, Caffey was an administrative agent. They would sign the lease and then subsequently assign it to Vantage. These plaintiffs, and the plaintiffs really in all of these cases, never got to that process. They never got past that step one, which they really weren't involved in at all. It's also important, I think, to understand this association that's called Southwest Fort Worth Alliance. It apparently is a collection of neighborhood associations, not all of which have any formality associated with their formation. The identities of these associations changed over time. Their participation in Southwest Fort Worth Alliance changed over time. Sometimes Southwest Fort Worth Alliance might be 13 associations, sometimes it might be 18, sometimes it might be 15, sometimes it might be 21. Who are these plaintiffs? There is no membership process for the underlying associations or Southwest Fort Worth Alliance. It is impossible, and I think the record clearly shows this, to identify the individuals that would supposedly be affected by this agreement, as it is called. The appellant's brief says there's somewhere between 4,000 and 7,500 people. That seems to me to be a lot of uncertainty, both about the identity of the individuals and the properties to be affected. And indeed, the plaintiffs in this case testified that they really didn't think they were members. They had never filled out any memberships. They had not done anything to become a member of anything. And why is this important? To me, it's important because I think we have to ask, how could Southwest Fort Worth Alliance create legal rights for persons whose identities were not and are not known? And secondly, And maybe more importantly, because this goes, I think, Justice Livingston, to your mutuality question, Southwest Fort Worth Alliance admittedly had no agency authority. How could Southwest Fort Worth Alliance create legal privileges in unknown individuals without having the authority to create a corresponding legal obligation? I'm sorry?
If all this is true, why are you dealing?
It was a communication facilitator. Southwest Fort Worth Alliance facilitated communications. That is essentially what they did. And it perhaps today and back in 2008 could have been possible to communicate individually through email, although I'm guessing in Southwest Fort Worth there probably are a lot of individuals who don't do business by email. But that's all they did. And the effort here, in my view, is really nothing more than to create a contract or contracts out of thin air. I do want to address quickly one point. In the appendix, I provided a chart that looked like this, only slightly smaller, and I know the court can't read this. But it demonstrates to me the theory that's necessary to try to form a contract when there's no evidence that one truly was made. The two main documents that are referred to by the appellants as the core documents are an email and a memorandum of understanding from August 22. Not signed by anybody, not complete in material terms, plainly not intended to be a binding agreement of any sort, a legally binding agreement. Then the appellants are obliged, in order to fill in material terms and whatever, to wander through about a 30-day excursion of various documents until they finally get to the end and say, voila, there's our contract. The problem they have is none of the various documents that they wander through and pick out refer back to the core documents that they say were the essence of the deal. And the core documents obviously don't refer to any of those later created documents since they did not exist. So the idea that they can collect up these documents into a pile and under Texas law make them a single binding contract is simply not correct.
Mr. Herman, did any of these emails, I've only read kind of the main ones, did any of them have like a time limit on the offer?
I don't think there was ever a time limit on the offer, but I don't think revocability or irrevocability is an issue here, because for a contract, if there were a contract and if it were to have been irrevocable for a period of time, that promise of irrevocability would have to have independent consideration attached to it. There is no evidence of anything like that. And the reason there's no evidence is nobody really thought they were making a contract in this process. It's only after the market fell out, and you know, practically, I think we all know what happened here. Gas prices dropped from $13 to $4 or below. It was no longer economic to offer bonuses of the character that had previously been offered. These people, along with many others, I'm not criticizing them, had been holding out, trying to drive the bonus number up from 15,000 to 17,000 to 20,000 to 25,000 an acre, and they just held out too long. It turned out to be uneconomic to make that deal. The other point I want to specifically talk to is this Uniform Electronic Transactions Act point that the appellants make. And it's their effort to get around the signature requirement of the statute of frauds. They say, well, Because these documents were transmitted electronically, they are deemed signed under the Uniform Electronic Transactions Act. But that act makes it clear that its purpose is not to alter or modify substantive law requirements. And to me, the interesting thing about their position here can be demonstrated by a little analogy. Let's say two businessmen in the same building are negotiating a contract, and they're sending drafts back and forth and back and forth and back and forth. Well, under the plaintiff's theories, if they hand deliver the drafts to each other, there is no contract. However, if they email the very same documents to each other, they are deemed signed and a contract is formed. Simply cannot possibly be the law, and is not the law. The other thing I want to just briefly talk about is the third-party beneficiary theory. It's clear under Texas law there are only two kinds of third-party beneficiaries. Donee beneficiaries, which are beneficiaries that receive the benefit of the agreement without giving up anything. That would be the life insurance beneficiary that Mr. Donheiser speaks about. These people are going to have to give up their mineral rights to receive the benefit of anything. They cannot be donee beneficiaries. And the other is creditor beneficiaries, and plainly, they don't fit into a creditor beneficiary status, which would be a situation where Southwest Fort Worth Alliance would owe them an obligation, and that obligation would be satisfied by Vantage's performance. But it's clear here that Southwest Fort Worth Alliance owed them no obligation. They owed Southwest Fort Worth Alliance no obligation back. They were not bound, the property owners were not bound to do anything, period, and Southwest Fort Worth Alliance had no authority to act in any way on their behalf. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you, Mr. Herman. Mr. Donheiser, rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor, and I'll try to be brief.
Justice Livingston asked a question about a time limit, whether this was open forever. It's not a temporal limitation. It's a geographic. You have to make the offer to these, to the unleased mineral estate owners in this. You don't have to leave it open forever. You just have to make the offer. Just like Blue Cross Blue Shield or whoever you has to make the offer to your children. If you say no, okay, that's it. It's over. You rejected the offer. Mr. Herman also made a fairly big deal about the process. Well, the process worked perfectly and simply. This was no big, elaborate dealings. Going in, the summary judgment evidence at least raises a fact issue, is not conclusive, that Vantage knew exactly who these people were. It was a matter of filling in two blanks on an agreed-upon lease form. They knew exactly who, because it was easy. You needed a software program and somebody knew what they were doing, and they hired one. It was very simple. They would go with these leases already filled out. Mr. Herman also made an issue of CIFWA not being a party to this. Well, CIFWA doesn't have a dog in this fight, Ms. Herman. It does not own mineral interests. What would it be doing here in this court arguing its relief is? It's, again, a third-party beneficiary contract. In a life insurance dispute, is the estate a party? It is if it's the beneficiary. But if it's not the beneficiary, does it care? Does it have legal standing to say you should have paid the finance company or whoever is the beneficiary, the children? No. The party who is getting the benefit is the party that brings the action. Mr. Herman also made an issue of the geographic boundaries of CIFWA changed over time, and that is true. But by the time they reached the agreement, they knew exactly what the boundaries were. They discussed which individual neighborhoods would be in, and by September of 2008, the exact geographic boundaries of CIFWA had been agreed upon. There is no question that the Webbers, that Ms. Weber and the Maddoxes are in CIFWA, that they were within that boundary. Vantage has not denied that. As to whether there was agreement, just look at the record here. Repeatedly, Vantage's president, its CEO, and vice president testified, yes, we had a deal with CIFWA for their endorsement. They use that word. They say there has been an offer and it has been accepted. That's Vantage's officers saying there has been an offer and it has been accepted. It's throughout our brief. That's clerk's record at 959. But numerous. There's no doubt here that they reached a deal. If there are no further questions, I'll give the time back.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Donahue.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Herman and Mr. Allen. We appreciate your arguments today and, of course, your briefing in anticipation of today's submission. Your case is now submitted, and we will take a brief recess. Well, actually, about a 50-minute recess until our 10:30 case. Thank you.
All right.